Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, my name is Alicia, and I'm an alcoholic. I am also a klutz, and there's a lot of electronic equipment up here, and I have an open cup of water, so I am afraid. But life is good. My sobriety date is May 15th of 2003, and I promise you that that girl that came in here had no idea who this woman was going to become. Also, if you have any complaints about my talk, this is the complaint number, just in case you weren't here earlier today. Give that person a call. They will be more than happy to help you, I promise. I'm going to read a little something out of the 12 and 12, actually, just to ground me and get me where I need to be so I can tell y'all what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. It's out of the 11th step on page 104. It says, in AA, we have found that the actual good results of prayer are beyond question. They are a matter of knowledge and experience. All those who have persisted have found strength, not ordinarily their own. Somebody's getting a phone call here. They have found wisdom beyond their usual capacity, and they have increasingly found a peace of mind which can stand firm in the face of difficult circumstances. We discover that we do receive guidance for our lives to just about the extent that we stop making demands upon God to give it to us on order and on our terms. Almost any experienced AA will tell you how his affairs have taken remarkable and unexpected turns for the better as he tried to improve his conscious contact with God. He will also report that out of every season of grief or suffering, when the hand of God seemed heavy or even unjust, new lessons for living were learned, new resources of courage were uncovered, and finally, inescapably, the conviction that God does move in mysterious ways, his wonders to perform. I also want to tell y'all about my home group. I love them. I have the most amazing, wonderful group of people. I'm a member... probably not in good standing at the moment, so I just had a kid. But I am a member of the Fraser Group of Alcoholics in the great state of Tennessee. And, Tennessee. Fraser is a city. I'm going to tell you a little bit about them later and how they saved my life and helped make me the person that I am today. Let's take you through a little journey of my alcoholism. Growing up, both my parents, beautiful Al-Anons, I'm an adult child of two Al-Anons, it's a very interesting experience. I had both working class parents. I grew up in Fraser. If any of you have been to Memphis, so you know Fraser is not the nice area of town. It's not where you have the, it's got really cool cars, but it's because a lot of people are drug dealers. But the houses are pretty dilapidated. It's not, you know, it's not the nice area of town. But again, the car is nice. My family life at home was kind of, you know, my dad worked overnight, my mom worked during the day. So, being that they're working class, they needed childcare. I stayed between my grandparents' houses a lot. And that was a weird experience because it was like having three lives. I had my dad's side of the family, my grandmother and my grandfather. And they were like what I would think of as like the perfect like Brady Bunch family. You know, my grandmother was the sweet woman who cooked in the kitchen and loved her grandchildren. You know, I spent many a day cooking with my grandmother. My grandfather was, he liked to hunt, he had guns, and he had a shed out in the back where he liked to build stuff. And I was the oldest daughter of my father's. I was the only. Anyway, whatever. We're past it. But I like to build stuff. I was the weird kid. I like to build stuff. Even though I'm a girl, I like to work with my hands and tools and stuff. So I spent a great many days in the work shed with my grandfather building birdhouses or trying to figure out how, like, this wrench worked to do this or, you know, doing different stuff like that. I majored in shop class in high school, too. So, you know, hey. Things work out. And then we had the other side of the family, my mother's side of the family. My mother had two brothers and a stepfather and her mother that all lived in the same house. And it was a party getaway. Please let me believe. There was a shed out back, a huge deck, like with tables and chairs. I mean, it looked like a restaurant, like literally, because every weekend there was a party going on for somebody or something. And it was one of those situations. We even had a bobcat, y'all, like craziness at this place. And it was one of those things, like, if you went out to the shed, you were supposed to bring back some form of alcohol in order to stock either the, you know, refrigerator on the back deck or the, you know, sliding glass door, you know, beer cooler on the deck or one of the mini bars in the house. And that's just the way it was. There was always drinking and, you know, carousing and just crazy stuff going on there all the time. So, I liked it. I kind of liked being there. I was a weird, quiet kid. I was really awkward from very early on. I was not a big fan of people. I loved books. I was the kid that would hide in the closet and read a book, or I was the kid that would be, you know, you have to yell my name 15 times before I hear you because I'm so engrossed in a book because I'm not paying attention to you. But I liked pretty things. I liked sparkly things. I was a kid, of course, and so I loved, very early on, the ritualism of alcohol, even before I knew what alcohol tasted like. I loved wine glasses. I loved rocks glasses. I used to figure out ways to concoct, like, sweet tea with just enough ice so that it looked like whiskey on the rocks, or I would drink grape juice or apple juice or something out of champagne flutes or wine glasses, you know what I mean? Because the ritual was so beautiful to me. And I wanted to be a part of that. I wanted to be a part of the beauty of alcohol. And I remember one day we were at my grandmother's house. And it was me and my little sister. We were running around. And my granny would let us take drinks of her wine and stuff, you know. And she was drinking like a wine cooler one day. And my, I can't remember if it was me or my sister, but one of us asked if we could try it. And she's like, sure. And you know, it was one of those, it was when Bartles, I don't know, I thought they created it that day, so I don't know, it may have been around a lot more, but it was like the Bartles and James wine coolers, you remember, like that, the strawberry daiquiri and peach fuzzy navel and, you know, different like that, you know. And so she gave us a sip of the strawberry one, and we loved it. So from then on out, you know, they decided, obviously, there's not a lot of alcohol in these wine coolers. So me and my sister would run around the house drinking wine coolers, like, all day long. And that was just okay. And so, I'm kind of a weird alcoholic. My first drink was when I was real, real young, and I don't have a whole lot of memory of it. But I just do remember that I really loved them. What happened was my sister and I were at the grocery store with my father because, again, my dad worked during the night, so he had to play Mr. Mom a lot and do a lot of things that he was very unhappy about, including grocery shopping. And we were at the grocery store one day, and my sister went running away from the cart towards, you know, the beer case in the grocery store, how there's the lower beer case, you know, that kids can get into because that's genius. And so my sister goes running over there and, like, dips in and, like, starts grabbing this case of wine coolers. And she's like, Daddy, Daddy, we need these. We need these. And my dad's like, no, no, those are for big people. And she's like, no, you don't understand. Alicia and I love these, Daddy. We have to have some for home, you know? And I'm like, ugh, I knew something was going to go terribly wrong. This is not going to be good for me. And so I'm, like, getting irritated. And I'm like, shut up, Andrew. We're fine. Just come on. Come on. Let's go, you know. And she's like, no, we have to have these, Alicia. Come on. You know we love these. And my dad's like, you have never had one of those. And she's like, we drink them at my granny's house all the time. Oh, there is no words to express the anger that crossed my dad's face. We did not finish grocery shopping. We went home. And it was one of the many times that in order to punish my grandparents for something that my parents thought they had done wrong, they would not let us go over there anymore. And it happened several times, but this one didn't last very long, but there was no more wine coolers for me, and I was very distraught and mad at my sister. So I had to go back to try to pretend that I had alcohol in my different glasses and stuff. I went to a private school growing up, and I hated it. I was not good at private school because, again, I did not like people, and I was poor. So there were all these girls that had all these cute clothes and all these cute things. They had, like, those, anybody else shot of the 80s and 90s? Y'all remember the pins with the furry, fuzzy, like, balls on the end? They were so pretty, and all the pretty girls had them, and they stuck them in their hair, and it was so pretty. I was not pretty, and I didn't have those, and I hated those girls because they had them, and I felt so insignificant because they had them and I didn't. I remember, like, we were so poor I couldn't afford the slap bracelet. So I'm, like, post-traumatic stress disorder here this weekend because y'all have slap bracelets. Because I do remember when they came out and I could not even afford to get a slap bracelet until they went, like, on clearance. And, of course, it had, like, the orange tags I couldn't completely get off. It was horrible. So, you know, I was not a fan of school because I didn't fit in. I didn't like it. I used to go home every day crying. My dad worked overnight. Sometimes I had to break into the house to get in. Sometimes he would forget and have to go get my sister first, and I'd be stuck at school. It was really weird. I didn't realize it was weird until I met other people that didn't have childhood like mine, until I met people who didn't have to break into their house, you know, and different things like that. I didn't know. But I learned to take care of myself pretty early. One day, I have to tell you this. I always get to this part and then I have to leave. So my family is very religious, which is fabulous. And they used to take me to Sunday school every Sunday morning. My grandmother did. She was very big in it. And I met this lady and she really liked me and she took an interest in me and she bought me a red Bible. It was beautiful leather-bound red Bible, and I loved it. And she had my name put on the inside and everything. It was this beautiful Bible. And I remember I loved that Bible so much. I used to take such good care of it. I was so excited because it was really the first book anybody bought me of my own, and I love books so much. But it was also the point that someone, I mean, it was red, which is my favorite color. It was like, it seemed like there was so much thought put into it. I love this Bible. And, you know, I had gone to church, and somewhere along the way, I had developed some animosity towards a higher power. I did not feel that some of the things I was being taught in church were maybe necessarily the way things could be. And so I got mad, and I, you know, at a very early age, I got really mad at God, and I just stopped participating and all that, which is really a sad, sad thing, but it did happen. But I remember the last thing that I ever remember thinking that God had done for me was that school that I hated going to so much closed down the summer of my eighth grade year, which was, I was finally going to get to go to public school, and I was so excited because there were going to be people just like me, and I was not going to have to be in this world that I didn't fit in anymore. But that was the last time that I really felt that God had done something for me, and I did. I believe that God had, like, reached down and closed those doors just for me that day. So I started going to high school at a public high school, a very big public high school in Memphis, which was a very big culture shock for me because it was very sheltered at the school that I had gone to before. There was a lot more diversity going into a new school and a new land, and it was very interesting. I saw for the first time people get beat up at school. There was a girl that got shot while I was at school one time. I got stabbed in the arm once. Long story, not even getting into that today, but it happened. I hung out with kids that were in gangs because they had alcohol, and they preferred doing drugs, and I preferred to drink, so we got along great. And I hung out with them, and, like, I was in some really shady neighborhoods at a really, really early age. Places that people shouldn't see. But I was a part of a crew. I was a part of something. I had friends at last, you know, and I was still really awkward, but I wasn't quite as awkward as I was before. You know, I got through high school again. I majored in shop class. I was a state officer for the Technology Student Association because I was awesome. But that's all I did in high school. Like, that was it. I did because I liked politics. I liked Robert's Rules of Order. I was really into that. That was all I did. I passed senior English because I cried during my exam and convinced my English teacher that I really had done all that work that I hadn't done and that she had just misplaced all of it. I graduated. I got through. I had picked up a job. That's another thing. Whenever I turned 16, I had to get out of my house because it was absolutely insane and I could not stand being around my family. And the only way that I could think of to get out and to get money so I could do what I wanted to do is get a job. So I got a job with a bunch of people I went to high school with, and we had an awesome time. And it was when alcohol actually worked for me. And we had the best times, I will tell you. But I was a hot mess, and I worked 40 hours a week in high school from 16 until I graduated. And I was never home because my mother... We know now she was depressed, but my mother was one of those people that whenever I would come home from school or when she would come home from work, she would either go straight to bed or she would go straight in front of the TV to play Dr. Mario, the, do y'all remember the game Dr. Mario Brothers? I can't hear that music. It's traumatizing. I'm not kidding. Like, it just makes me, like, crazy. But she did, like, every day. That's what she did, sat in front of the TV and played Dr. Mario. It was really weird. But bless her heart, you know, that's what she did. And that's what she had to do to cope. And I had to do what I had to do to cope. And I had to run away. Which is horrible because I loved my sister a lot. And I really did love her. But I could not bring her along with me to where I was then. And I had raised her for a long time, y'all. I took care of her. My sister was my baby. I cooked. I cleaned. I did stuff around the house. You know, I was little Miss Mom, you know. And by the time they got bad enough that I couldn't be there anymore, I had to actually look at her and be like, I'm out. And I'm sorry. I cannot help you. And I cannot bring you with me. So I graduated. I got a job. In the restaurant industry, because I wasn't making enough money at Super Kmart. And very quickly, because I'm one of those alcoholics that like to be the best at everything so that people pay attention to me, I very quickly got promoted, and I became a bartender, which is a fabulous job if you're a drinker. And I was one of those bartenders. I had every drink. I had memorized every book. You could not play with me. Like, I was there. I knew it all. You know, and it was fun, but life started getting really bad. We were entering, like, the black years, and I can't believe that I survived. And not just because of my alcoholism, but because life was so crazy. But somehow I managed to get through. During this time, my dad, when I was a lot younger, he started going to these meetings on Sunday night and Monday night. Sunday night and Monday night were always his days off. And he started one of these meetings. And so I intuitively thought that since he was going to meetings that were for work, and that he was going to start bringing in more money so that everything was going to be okay, because that had become the answer to life. If we have money, then everything's going to be okay, because we did not have money and everything was not okay, obviously. So I came to find out later on that my dad had actually started going to Al-Anon. And so we had this moment where, like, we were the big, like, Al-Anon family. Like, my dad went to Al-Anon because he was interested in it, and he was trying to make his life different. My dad had been an absentee father, except for the moments that we had gone grocery shopping and stuff, you know what I mean? And now all of a sudden, he's, like, taking an interest in our lives. My sister started going to Alateen because she was of that age, you know, and that's what you do when you're that age, is you go to Alateen because your parents force you to, and you hate it, and you become an alcoholic later. And then my mom went to Al-Anon because she was trying to scope out and figure out if my dad was, like, cheating on her, what was really going on, like, why he was there, you know what I mean? Because there had to be some motive. And so I got dragged into Al-Anon, too. And I did not like it, and I was not a fan. What I preferred to do was, like, drop my mom off at the Al-Anon meeting and then go drink while she was at the meeting and then come back and get her. And that's what I did a lot of the time, in all honesty. But every once in a while, I would go to an Al-Anon meeting, and it would, you know, be whatever. I remember one particular time that I was, like, just completely and utterly distressed. Like, life was horrible. It was distraught. My dad had taught me into going into the meeting. And I went to this meeting. It was in a church. And I was sitting in the meeting, and I hated Al-Anon meetings because all they did was complain about their alcoholic husbands or their alcoholic boyfriends. And I'm like, dude, just go drink with him. You will not be so crazy, and it will be awesome. You will have a great time together. Trust me. Like, I could not understand what they had to argue about because my alcoholics had abused me. Like, I could not understand what they were complaining about. You know what I mean? Their alcoholics did not sound that bad to me. Like, okay, your boyfriend stayed out partying until 6 a.m., why don't you just try it? It might be fun, you know? Why don't you come to me when you have bigger problems than that, was basically my idea. But I remember sitting in an Al-Anon meeting this one particular day, and I looked across the hall, and there were all these people across the hall, and they were having a great time. I had never noticed those people before, and I had no idea who those people were. But they looked like the kind of people that I wanted to be hanging out with, not these mopey women in here complaining about their husbands and boyfriends. Anyway, I left. Life got crazy. My parents decided to get a divorce, and it destroyed me. Now, mind you, I hadn't had a family in a long time, but I was 18 years old, and 18 years old is not the time for your family to, like, all of a sudden break apart. So you're, like, standing there like, but I've always had a family. What do you mean we're, like, separating, you know? My grandmother got cancer, and my grandmother was the only person that I ever thought that paid any attention to me throughout my life. And I was so disturbed. I did not know what was going to happen to her. My sister started getting sick and having to go in the hospital. My mom and I stopped talking for, like, over a year because, I don't know, it was just everything. I was still working. My alcoholism was growing stronger and stronger and stronger. I'm starting to black out, so I would wake up without, how many people woke up with underwear and bras in their back pocket? That was me. I like to get naked whenever I'm drunk, apparently. It was probably the tequila, because I did like tequila. But that was one of the ways whenever I first got sober, in all honesty, that I knew that I had not come home drunk, because sometimes I would wake up and be afraid I had relapsed and not know, but I would be fully clothed, so I had to know that I was okay. Anyway, things just got really crazy and complicated, and I couldn't breathe. I fell in love with this little redheaded boy, and then he fell out of love with me, and broke my heart. And things just kept cycling out of control, and I couldn't grab onto anything. Like, I had no ability to grasp anything that was going on in my life, and I had no idea why. And things got worse. My sister got sicker. My mama got less talkative. My dad started getting crazy. I had attempted to do things to myself that are not things that you should do yourself, and things just got way out of control. And alcohol went from being fun to being the solution to my problems. And I don't know when, but it was somewhere in that black period that it became the answer. Because the thing is, whenever I drank, I was not one of those people that thought that alcohol made me, like, beautiful, long hair, curves, and that all the boys were going to love me, I was going to dance. Alcohol made me feel like I thought all of y'all felt all the time. Alcohol gave me the ability to exist in the world like I thought everybody else existed. I thought I was the one that was made differently. And if I had just been given the tools that everybody else had, I could have made it. But since I didn't have those, I had to drink, because that was the only answer I had. And one day I woke up and I was 23, and I was living with my mom. We had started talking again because I had to get away from my dad because he was concerned about my drinking. jerk. So I went to live with my mom and my stepfather and my sister, and I hadn't done anything. I mean, I was working, I was making money. I was about as functional as you can get. But I was dying, and I hated breathing, and I don't even know how I was doing it at that point. And I woke up one day and I called. It was Sunday. Me and my dad went into things whenever I moved out. One of our deals was that we would meet every Sunday and have dinner. We'd meet at the Starbucks, and then we would go and have dinner somewhere, and that's what we did. And so I woke up one Sunday, and it was like 3 in the afternoon, and I was supposed to meet him at 4, and I was still really messed up. And I had done things the night before that was that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, those things that I swore I would never, ever, ever, ever do. I did them, and I liked them, and I enjoyed them, and they were bad, and I did not want to do them anymore. And I knew at that point that something was going to be really, really bad, that I was not going to make it through this, right? So I call my dad, and I'm trying to figure out what to do, you know. So I call my dad, and I'm like, hey, I'm going to come, and, you know, let's have, you know, dinner or whatever. And he's like, okay. And so I get in the car, still intoxicated. And I drive 20 minutes to go meet my dad. Genius. And I'm hysterically crying, y'all. I'm crying those tears of an alcoholic, you know, when you're broken and you can't get up anymore and you don't have that cool button to call the people to help you. Like, you're just distressed and broken and there's nothing that anybody can do to help you. And I did. I was, like, suffocating. I was crying so hard I could not breathe. And I'm just trying to get to my dad because, I don't know, it just seemed like the right thing to do. So whenever I got in the parking lot, obviously I cleaned myself up so I would look okay. And I went in to meet my dad. And, you know, we had coffee for a minute, and then we went to go have dinner. And for some reason that day he wanted me to ride with him. And that wasn't usually how we did it. We usually took separate cars. So I jumped in his truck, and we went to the Pig and Whistle Barbecue, Bartlett, Tennessee, and sat down to have dinner. And we sat there, and the waitress took our orders, and she brought us drinks. And I started crying, and I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop. And my dad's like, what's wrong, baby? What's wrong? You know, because due to the program of Al-Anon and Al-Anon family groups, I had gotten a father, and I'm so grateful for that, you know. And he was genuinely concerned, and he wanted to help me, you know. I can't imagine what it must have been like for him to sit across and see his daughter breaking like that. But he's like, what can we do, baby? What do you need? And I said, I need to not be like this anymore. He's like, well, what do you need? What do you need to do? Do you need to go to therapy? So if you need to go to therapy, I'll pay for it. Like, come on, well, you know, we'll get you in therapy. It's all going to be fine. I was like, I don't need to go to therapy, Dad. And he's like, well, what do you need? You want to go to Al-Anon? I'll call Kathy. I don't even have to go with you. We'll take you to an Al-Anon meeting. You know, there are people there that can help you. Maybe if you need a sponsor this time, you know. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I'm like, I don't need to go to Al-Anon, Dad. And he's like, well, where is it that you need to go, Leisha? And I was like, I need to go to that other place. And he's like, what other place? I was like, you know, the other place where people go that are like me. That's where I need to go. And he's like, Leisha, where is that place? You need to go to therapy. You need to go to Al-Anon. Like, what is it? Where do you need to go? And I wanted him to say it so bad. I wanted him to know where I needed to go. And I needed him to say it, but he wouldn't. He would not say it for me. And I looked at him and I said, Dad, I need to go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And he jumped up and yelled, check, please. And the waitress came over and he's like, forget the food, we don't need boxes, just here's my credit card, we gotta go. So he starts on his phone, like, calling people, and I'm like distraught and I'm like, I just messed up. This is not good. And I knew it. So anyway, he gets me in the car, and we're driving, and I'm still crying because I'm still breaking, and now I'm really confused as to what's going to happen in my life. And he's like, come on, baby, we need to find you an AA meeting. We need to find somebody that can help you. If I can just find you an alcoholic, everything's going to be okay. We have to find you an alcoholic. I'm like, okay. And he's like, just pray that there's one there. You know, he's like, I think they have a meeting there on Sunday night. He's like, but I'm going to take you, and maybe there will be somebody there that can talk to you. He's like, let's pray. And grabs my hand. And I'm like, well, no, let's not do that. And he's like, come on, let's pray. Let's do the serenity prayer. And I'm like, okay, because I had been around long enough to know that. And so we said the serenity prayer. And now I'm angry because I'm like, this is really a bad idea. but I stuck with it, you know, because what was he going to do, jump out of the truck? Anyway, so he pulled up at this place that I used to take him and my mom to meetings to all the time. And it was by a bar that I used to do bad things at. And, you know, we got out, and he's like, there are only two cars here. Let's just pray that one's an alcoholic. And we go in the building, and there's this old woman lurking about. And he's like, is there, who's here? Is Earl here? And she says, yeah, he's in the back. And so my dad goes running to the back and brings out, like, this 900-year-old man, y'all. I am not kidding. He had to be God's best friend while he was creating the world. Like, it was bad. And I'm like, what? And so my dad's like, just sit down and talk. Then y'all talk, and it's going to be okay. And he's like, Earl, my daughter thinks she has a drinking problem. And so we sit down at this really long table, and the woman is still skulking about over to the side, like, cleaning and wiping stuff down and, like, looking at me. And I'm like, oh, God, it's like the Twilight Zone. So, and my dad's, like, they're repairing this place. So my dad's in the bathroom, like, whistling and singing, like, trying to stay busy so that he doesn't participate because, like, I have destroyed his Al-Anon program, like, in 5 minutes. And so, like, all of this insanity is going on, and I'm like, whoa. But this man sat down with me. This 900-year-old man that was there during the creation of the world sat down with me. And he told me about his life and the things and how they had changed. And I did not relate to him at all. Because he was male and he was a lot older than me. And, you know, I didn't want to relate to him because I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just didn't want to hurt anyone. But he didn't want anything from me. And he sat there with me for about an hour. And talked to me without wanting anything from me in return. And it was the first time that anybody had sat with me for an hour without wanting anything in return for a really, 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 really long time. And I left there that night, and I went to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting the very next day. And I left that Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and went and got drunk. And I went to another Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Actually, I called my dad after that. And I was like, I can never go back to AA. And he's like, what have you done? And I was like, they're never going to let me go back. It's horrible. And he's like, well, did you go to a meeting? I'm like, yeah. He's like, well, did you get a sponsor? And I was like, well, no, they didn't mention that. It's just, you know, they just talked to me about how, you know, painful everything is or whatever. And he's like, didn't anybody tell you to keep coming back? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, that's what they meant. And I was like, oh, I just thought it was like, if you stayed sober, you get to be in the club. And he's like, no. So, because we speak a different language in AA, you know, kids coming in off the streets, they don't know what keep coming back means. I didn't. I mean, and I thought I was pretty smart. So I go to a meeting, and then I got drunk, and I go to another meeting, I get
get drunk, and I got the little book that tells you where the meetings are, and I'm going to try all these different meetings, and there's always old men, and there's always smoke, and there's always coffee. And I was cool with the smoke. I wasn't a big fan of coffee at the time. And old men, whatever. But I kept leaving and getting drunk, you know? I kept leaving and getting drunk. But I remembered one night in the midst of a drink, I was sitting at the end of the bar, and I was hurting real, real bad. And I was remembering when I was in Al-Anon, I had gone to a meeting, and there were a bunch of people there, and it was the funnest Al-Anon meeting I'd ever been to. And there was a place called We Aren't Alone Lot, and I wonder if they had an AA meeting. So there's a lot of big groups that, you know, had both. So the next day I went to that meeting, and I got a sponsor because there was this really cute redheaded lady. I'm in a different place right now. I usually have red hair. I've decided to do brown for a while. My hair is usually red. I paid a great deal of money all of my life to have red hair. Anyway, so they're in this meeting, sitting there broken, and somebody had told me, you know, find a sponsor and find someone you want, what they have, or you can relate to. And there was this cute little old woman there with red hair. So obviously, I could relate to her. And I go up to her after the meeting, and I can only imagine the hot mess I looked like, because she kind of looked taken aback by me. And I was like, hi, and she's like, hi, and I was like, can I get your phone number? And, you know, in case you don't know, in newcomer words, that means I'm really broken, and I don't know what to do. Can you please save me, because I don't know where to go from here. And I guess she didn't understand or know how to translate, so she's like, yeah, and here, you can get this lady over here's number two, and pointed at this chick who'd been crying during the whole meeting. I looked. Because what she had told me was, but I don't want to be your sponsor, you need to go talk to that chick over there that's crying. And so I looked at this chick and sized her up, and since she was crying, I decided that absolutely she needed to be my sponsor, because I was going to be able to manipulate her and do whatever I wanted to. So, anyway, I get this chick's number, and she's like, hey, let's go and get some coffee and let's talk. And so I'm like, okay. And she brings this 14-year-old kid with her. And so we go, and she's over talking to somebody at the coffee shop, and me and this 14-year-old kid, I'm the right old age of 23, and he's 14, and he's got 2 years sober, and he's like, oh my God, this is gonna be so much fun, we're gonna have the best time ever. He's like, you're gonna get sober, we're gonna be friends, and it's gonna be awesome, and this is gonna be the best ever, you're gonna have such a great life. And I'm like, oh my God, you're 14, you don't know about me, you know? And I was grossly offended. But anyway, I let him go over, and we talked for a minute. And you know, we agreed that she was gonna be my sponsor. And the next night after leaving work, I stopped at a gas station to get gas, and I got back in the car, and there was a 6-pack of beer there, and I have no idea where it came from, literally to this day. 6-pack of beer sitting there. And so I had an option. I could either drink the beer or go to my sponsor's house. But I had not worked any of the steps in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had not even opened the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, I think I still called it the Biblu book at the time, because I really wasn't sure what I called it. And I thought you could buy it at Barnes & Noble, but I wasn't sure. And I drank the beer. I drank the beer. And I woke up the next morning. And I didn't wake up the next morning and look at the sun and say, oh, I'm going to go to rehab today. It's a beautiful day. I jumped out of bed and goes, holy shit, I have to be at work in 10 minutes. What am I going to do? So I called my mom and I was like, I got to go to rehab because I didn't want to lose my job. And she's like, what do you mean? And so they called my insurance. She came and got me. And they took me, not to rehab, to the mental asylum. That's always good. And you know, this guy's getting beside me, and he's like, do you mind if your mom sits in here with us? And I'm like, no. And then he starts asking me all these personal questions that I was not going to answer in front of my mother, because she did not need to know this stuff about me. So I lied all the way through it. And then he's like, okay, I just need you to sign this piece of paper, and you're going to be here for like 3 days. And I'm like, okay. And 3 months later, I finally saw the light of day. It was ugly. I was there forever. And it was different levels. Like, please don't mistake me. I did finally end up in the rehab portion, but they had to shake a lot of demons out of this one before I could even get to the point where we could look at my alcoholism. So I was broken, y'all. And I had done a good job of freaking myself for a long, long time. So anyway, my sponsor came up there that while I was in rehab, and she's like, you know, do what they tell you to do while you're in here. Learn as much as you can. And then when you get out, we're going to work the real steps out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what she did. You know, I lived in meetings my first year sober. My life completely ran around meetings. I would wake up, I would go to work. I would get off about 11:30 because I worked at a coffee shop and I work early. And I would get off in time to go to the noon meeting. And then I would stay after the noon meeting and clean the bathrooms because my sponsor was a big fan of me cleaning bathrooms. And I did that. I would clean the bathrooms and then I would sit and do whatever book work I had and I would get lunch or something and I would sit there till the 5:55 meeting started when everybody started rolling in. And I would stay there until my sponsor got there, and we would go to that meeting. And then afterwards, she would decide, because it was sponsor picket afterwards, and we would go to an 8 o'clock meeting. And then from the 8 o'clock meeting, if there was not a 10 o'clock meeting that she thought I could get some recovery at, she would allow me to go home. And that's how I lived for a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, she got me in the big book, and she showed me what an alcoholic was, you know. When we started this book, she made me start with the prefaces. She said, you start with the front page. You need to learn about what Alcoholics Anonymous is. There's history in this, you know. You need to know why you're doing it. You need to know what an alcoholic is. I've sat in meetings and listened to you introduce yourself as an alcoholic. What is an alcoholic? And it's like, it means I drink too much? And she's like, that's not what an alcoholic is. There are lots of people that drink too much. Let's get in the book. And she did, and we got in the book, and we read the doctor's opinion, and I found out that I had a allergy. I have a physical craving, which means once I take alcohol into my body, I cannot stop. I'm completely incapable of it. It doesn't have anything to do with any outside circumstances or anything else. I can be happy, I can be sad, I can be like, eh, whatever. What it means is if I put one drop of alcohol into this body right here, I'm never going to stop until I end up passed out, throwing up, wherever. Once I cannot physically get to it anymore, that's when I will stop. And then when I read Bill's story, and I read about the unmanageability of alcoholism, you know, I'm so grateful for Scott last night talking about, you know, how the circumstances and our consequences are not the reason why we're alcoholics, you know. What I had to learn was that my circumstances were the result of actions that I had taken while drinking. But my inability to live life on my terms, that was the unmanageability. And I had to learn that I had this mental obsession that meant whenever I was not drinking, I was trying to figure out who I had to con to get the drink, and when I had to con them, and how I had to con them, or what I had to do, how many checks I can float, can I pay my tab on Thursday when my check comes in at 6 o'clock in the morning and have no money to pay my car note, and who's going to do it? Those are the things that I had to figure out. I spent a lot of time thinking about how I was going to get this taken care of so I could get what I needed to get so that I could breathe, just so that I could breathe. We were past the point of being able to live by now. And so, but I learned. I learned what an alcoholic was, and I learned that my circumstances were just an after effect, that the bigger problem was me, and that I didn't know how to live, and that I believed these bad things about myself. And then we got into Step two. And step two was really hard for me because one of the first things I told my sponsor was that I was an atheist and I was not interested in her God stuff and to leave me alone about that and we could do everything else with that. And she's like, okay, whatever. So anyway, by the time we did finally get to that, I was so scared because I had believed in God at one point, you know? And I had gotten really angry at him, and I had said some really ugly things about God in my little time about. And so I didn't really think that he wanted to have anything to do with me. But I got home one night, and I found that red Bible that I had talked about earlier. And it was in a box in the very back of my closet, because, you know, when you're getting sober at first, you have nothing better to do than clean out your closets and find everything. And I did. I was cleaning out a closet, and I found this old red Bible, and I opened it up, and there was, on the front few pages, there was like, again, I'm talking about the 80s and 90s, it was like, I heart God, and I heart Jesus, and, you know, all this stuff, and it reaffirmed to me that at one point I had a relationship with a higher power, at one point that I had cared, at one point I had love, but pomp and calamity had taken over, and I had become blinded, and not been able to see that relationship for what it was anymore. And so it opened me up a little bit, and I became a little willing. And then I was worried about getting it right. So I was a weird kid in AA. I traveled with a backpack, which most, you know, a lot of, you know, kids do. But I had my little backpack, and it had my big book, my 12 and 12, my notebook, my book that I was drawing and doing calligraphy in. I had a Kabbalah, Bhagavad Gita, Quran, mala beads, a dreidel. I had a thumb rosary. that I would do my third step prayer with, and because I wanted to make sure my bases were covered, y'all. I was going to get the right God at the right time, you know, and I wanted to make sure that I had all of it. I wanted to know that I had the right God, you know, because I did not want to do this anymore. Like, I was done, you know, so I was looking for God in all the wrong places, literally, and you know, but I was searching, you know, and I would have these like weird little atheist moments. You know, I remember I was out having a burger with my dad one day, because I was poor and he felt bad. So he bought me lunch and we're sitting there and I'm reading, an article in the newspaper because I'm one of those people that do that. And it's talking about like all these horrible things that are going on over in the country in Africa about these, you know, kids that are getting, you know, sold into sex slavery and all this stuff. And it like broke my heart and I'm just sitting there and I was like, how could a God ever let any of this happen? And y'all, I swear, the colors in the world changed. Because I had started to believe in something enough that there was actually color coming back into my world. But just that brief moment of questioning, and all of a sudden it was monochromatic again. And it scared me. It scared me more than anything. And I didn't know what to do. And I seriously prayed about it, thought about it, considered it. And what I ended up deciding was I would rather live in a technicolor dream world with a God that, you know, maybe I don't understand everything than live in this ugly monochromatic world that has nothing for me anymore. And so again, you know, I kept trudging along and I kept seeking God and kept reading these books and looking for, you know, how to make a higher power that worked for me. And then I was in a meeting one night, and this girl that I hated because she looked like one of the girls that had the fluffy pins and private school I went to that had money. And she was sharing during a 10-10 candlelight meeting, and it was on God, which, you know, was already in a bad place because of that. And she was sharing, and she said, you know, she said, it's not necessarily the point that, here, I'll put it this way. She said, if we were all laying on the ground, we're all laying on a field, and we're looking at the sky, and there's clouds in the sky, she said, I may look at the cloud and see a turtle. You may look at the cloud and see a choo-choo train. You may look at the cloud and see, you know, whatever it is you see. It's not the point of what we see in the clouds that matters. It's that we take the time to look. And at that moment, I developed a relationship with a higher power, because it became less and less and less about looking what was the right answer, but just to keep searching. And I did some inventory in my second step because I was so angry at God, and I had a lot of stuff that I had to look at. You know, my sponsor was hateful, and she made me start inventories at step two to look at why I was so judgmental, why I was self-righteous, what were the things that were blocking me from the sunlight of the Spirit, you know. And so finally I took those papers and I'm like, all right, I'm ready to go over this. I think I'm there. And I told her, you know, I was like, I'm just going to, you know, see what I see on a day-to-day basis and move from there. And she was happy with that. We moved to step three. Step three is tricky because it asks you more than once if you're ready for it. You know what I mean? Like, you don't just jump in there and do it and woo-hoo. It's like, okay, thinking we may be ready at step three, and then are you really, really ready? And then, okay, here's the prayer. Let's do it. And so she's like, you know, go home and read this. Make sure you've got it, and we're going to pray it. And, you know, whenever I took my step three on my knees in her bathroom, because we could smoke in there, I don't know why, but I did. It was in the bathroom by the toilet. on my knees, I took my third step prayer, and I made a commitment. It was a commitment. I made a commitment to a higher power, and I didn't know what the commitment was going to look like, and I didn't know how it was going to work out, and I didn't know any of those things. But at that point, like, it was basically me saying, I'm in. I want you to take me. Let's do this together, and let's show these people what you can do. Let's do it. And then I did not do my fourth step immediately, because I did. I started working on it, and then it got stolen with a backpack. And of course, I decided it was going to show up on some internet site or something, and everybody was going to know all this horrible stuff about me. And then I started it again, and like my sisters found it. And I just decided that, you know what? The object of the book is to find a power greater than yourself. It says it three times. I've done that. I'm good. I don't need to do a fourth step. And I started getting miserable. And I was at a women's retreat that I go to, and they were harassing me about it because by this time I had a couple of years sober, and they're like, you have to do your fourth step. And I'm like, I'm going to do it. Anyway, and this one lady sat down with me with a big book, and she showed me in the fifth step where it said, we thought we had leveled our pride, we thought we had looked our shortcomings, we thought all this thing, but inevitably, we ended up getting drunk, basically, is what it said. I'm sorry, I'm paraphrasing. I can't memorize the whole big book. I'm good. I'm not that good. So, but it made me realize that, you know, she's right. You know, I was using my relationship with God as a justification for not building a greater relationship with God and for cleaning out that stuff that had been blocking me. And so they made me sit down immediately and start to work on it because they're jerks. And I did, and I got it finished. And I called my sponsor. I'm like, hey, you know, I got my fifth step, fourth step done. Let's do this fifth step thing and get it done with, you know? And it took me a long time to do my fifth step because I had done a lot of damage even in me. You know, the thing about the fourth step is I had been my anger, my sex inventory, and my resentments, and I had to look at everybody I had harmed, and there was lots of stuff, you know, we broke it down into the columns, and I did all that, and I looked at my part, and, you know, whenever I sat down with my sponsor, the greatest thing in the world happened. I became an active participant in my life. I had lived under the delusion that I was a victim of circumstance, a victim of life, a victim of God, a victim of everything and nothing for so many years. But when I put pen to paper and looked at my heart and my life, I became an active participant in my life. And it meant that I wasn't a victim anymore. It meant that I had been there and I had participated. And because of that, it gave me the ability to move on and become the person that I was supposed to be. After doing my fifth step, I went home and did my stuff. I mean, put my book up on the shelf and all that stuff. I looked at everything. So I was in it. You know, I wanted to do it right. So I went and I meditated for an hour, see if I'd left anything out, and went over the steps in my head, and everything that we'd done, and everything we talked about, was I really an alcoholic? Had I started a relationship with God? You know, did I really believe that it was going to work? You know, did I leave anything out of my fourth step? Is there anything working? What, you know, what is it? After my hour, I didn't have anything, and I said my seventh step prayer, and I meant it. I got on my hands and knees, and I offered all of me to God, good and bad. Please take it. Let's do this. I'm ready. Let's go. And I woke up the next morning, and I went to work, and by noon, I had done every horrible shortcoming and character defect that there was to do, and I was horrified. Like, I acted worse in that day than I have ever acted in my life, and I called my sponsor in hysterics, and I'm like, you know, I have done all these horrible things in one day. I made a commitment to God last night. He was supposed to take all of me. Like, what happened? Like, why am I crazy today? And she's like, Alicia, you have to learn how to take positive actions to life instead of negative reactions. You have been living out of your negative toolkit all of these years. Those tools are all still there. Just because we give you some spiritual tools don't mean that all the negative ones go away. You have to learn which tools fit to what things. You have to figure out how to make positive decisions instead of just dipping back into survival mode and making the decision that seems the right then. And so she started me then looking at 10 step and every night looking at, you know, what could I have been different? How could it have been better? You know, even if I'd done something that necessarily didn't harm anybody, you know, there's some different things that I could have done. We burnt my fourth step, so I had to write my eighth step list from, scratch. I should have read ahead on that one, obviously. But I was really scared because I had sat in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings for a long, long time hearing people talking about their eighth step. And one of the things that I always heard is people were like, I'm going to make living amends. And I was ready for that because I can manipulate real good. And I knew, like, living amends, I was on that. If I could just get her to let me do all living amends, then my life was going to be great. But I know just enough honesty that when we sat down with my list and we were going to decide how I was going to go about making my amends, I was like, I think that I will die if you don't give me some form of action to take on every single one of these. I said, I know that there are amends that I cannot make directly because some of the people that I have harmed. I said, but I need to do something. And so we did. We sat down with my list and we came up with how I was going to do amends for every single person on that list. And for the people that I couldn't do things for directly, there were going to be other things I could do, like getting involved in different forms of community events and doing different service works and things like that outside of the ranks of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. One thing that my amends and my fourth step showed is that I've been a tornado. And one thing about tornadoes is tornadoes just don't affect the people they come in direct contact with, you know? They affect all the people in the surrounding area and the people that know those people and the people that might have been in the car that ran around that person that day, you know? I did a lot of damage, and I had to take responsibility for that, and so I had to get involved. I had to do things, you know? Sometimes it was as little as, you know, painting something and dropping it off in a nursing home for someone without taking credit for it. Sometimes it was planning out a community event for work. I mean, there was a lot of different things that we looked at and looked at that I had to do. I had to make some direct amends, too. The hardest amends that I had to make was my dad. He'd been at Al-Anon for, like, 20-something years. Hello, not fun. And I owed him a lot of money, so I had manipulated him in order to get what I wanted. I even knew that, like, at certain points, if I cut my hair off and dyed it black, he would, like, automatically give me $500. So, and I did those things, like, on purpose, so I could do what I needed to do. And so, I had a lot that I had to make up for him. And, you know, whenever I went and made amends to him, it was not just to go and be a simple, you know, I'm sorry for all those things I did to you, but it was, I had to admit up and to tell him, you know, I did these things, and I had to be specific. I did these things, and they were absolutely wrong. I want to make them right, and what can I do, you know? And, of course, he's crying. He's not covering. He can just do nothing. I mean, please, let's not do that. I need to live, so let's do something, you know? And, my dad and I have the best relationship. He's my best friend, you know, because of this program and because of the program he worked, we've been able to build a relationship. We talk about spirituality. We go sit up at Starbucks some days on the patio. Y'all, we're such dorks. He'll be reading a book when I walk up, so I'll just sit down and read my book, and until we get to stopping places, we ignore each other's existence. And then we'll talk. We talk about God, and we talk about politics. We talk about big things, you know? And we don't always see eye to eye, and we don't always agree, but we build a relationship built on mutual respect because of the people that we have become because of 12-step programs. And that's a beautiful thing. Not everybody in this world gets that, you know? 10-step, I'm not great at that. I do not do that every night. I'm going to lie. And I'm grateful that I have an awesome sponsor who, whenever I'm doing crazy stuff, will, you know, let me know about it. You know, sometimes it takes a long time for him to get to where he thinks I'm at a point that I can take care of something, you know? But I believe in him, and I trust him enough to know that he will not lead me on the path wrong. And I'm so grateful for that today. Sponsorship is the most important thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. You need someone that you can trust that, you know, has your best interest at heart, and that knows the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and is involved in service. My sponsor is deeply involved in service, and I also have a service sponsor who's deeply involved in service because I do a lot of stuff, and I need to make sure that I'm not making decisions based on self for the greater good of Alcoholics Anonymous, because please believe y'all should be doing it my way. Step 11, self through prayer and meditation, you know, my relationship with God has gone from something I had to fight so hard for. It's like, you know, that sweater that you love that you don't want to get rid of, that it's like old and it's got holes in it, but it's so comfortable and it's the only one that'll keep you warm the way that you need to keep being kept warm, but, you know, people look at you weird whenever you have it on, you know. You know, that's how my relationship with God has become. It's become so comfortable, you know. But I had to work on that relationship. It did not just happen, you know. I had to spend time with my higher power. I didn't just, you know, push him to the wayside until things got bad, you know. I went and had coffee with God, you know. I would write him letters and send him text messages and different things like that, you know. And if you got one of those text messages, I'm sorry, you know. But I did. I mean, I would just do really random off-the-wall stuff because I needed to make sure that I maintained this relationship. It was important to me, and it still is to this day. Please believe in me. My life in sobriety has not been perfect. I have made a lot of decisions that if I didn't have a higher power there to give me strength and wisdom, like, I would not be here today. Please believe. Step 12, I love working with women, but, you know, I will tell you one thing. You apparently have to be really, 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 really desperate to want me as a sponsor. I found that in my time, and that's okay. Like, I'm good with it. I'm last chance. Like, if you can't get sober, call me. I'm not for the faint of heart. Like, you gotta want it. I'm not kidding. And that's okay. Like, I'm really okay with that. I get people that, like, have 10 years sober and they're coming up. They're like, I'm gonna die. Please help me. I'm like, okay. I actually had a girl, I can't remember, but it's multiple personality disorders. And sometimes I would have to do step work and one of her other personalities would show up. I had one of them that tried to convince me one time that because, you know, one of them was an alcoholic didn't mean the other one was. And I was like, well, actually, y'all all share the same body. And because we have the phenomenon of craving, you are, technically. So it doesn't matter if you have the obsession or not, you know. But because of the Blue Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew how to deal with that circumstance. Because let me tell you, there are not a lot of people that you can talk to about that. Because not everybody has that experience, you know. But I did, and that's how you handle it if it ever happens to you. you know, but, you know, I've done a great many things in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got involved with young people. I hated young people. I did not want to get involved with y'all. My sponsor made me do it because I was smart with a girl when she invited me to a circuit pop post-committee meeting, and they made me the hospitality chairperson, and my first walk call was circuit pop, my first year sober, and I fell in love, and my next YPA was the Tiki Bar in Jackson, and I took a bid. I'd never been to a Tiki Bar in my life, and I went with a bid. And there were three of us, and I got smart with the advisory council, which is never a good idea. But, you know, 3 years later, we got Tiki Bar back to Memphis, you know? And I became an advisory council member, and people get smart with me, but it's fine. And and I actually serve as the chairperson for the Tennessee Conference of Young People and Alcoholics Anonymous Advisory Council, you know. I serve right now on the area committee for my state because I believe in general service. I believe in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I do not believe that young people's work is the only work that I have to do. There's so much. Like, we could be here for days, but we're not going to, so I'm not like that. What it's like now. I moved up in my company and got a really good job, making really good money. I'm a manager for a coffee company that and I loved it. I loved it, loved my job. I've been there since I got sober. It was the job I got after sobriety, you know. I built this life for myself in my recovery that I decided was the life that I needed for me. And I kept people at bay and kept people at arm's length on purpose in order to not have to change the circumstances of my life the way that I wanted them. Because I thought I needed to be perfect in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I let my guard down long enough that I got pregnant by a boy that thinks he does drugs. And he's not one of us. And he never worked with us. I didn't meet him here. And I had to call my sponsor. I called him and I was like, hey. He's like, hey, how's your day? He's like, good. How's yours? I was like, oh, you know, it's good. And he's like, what's going on? I was like, I just took a pregnancy test. And he goes, oh. I said, and it's positive. And he said, well, that's big news. And I didn't know what I was going to do, you know. I didn't know what I was going to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. But I'm very grateful because he didn't ask me what I was going to do. He said if I needed anything, he'd be there. My friends that I told when I didn't know what I was going to do, they didn't ask me what I was going to do. They hugged me and said they'd be there for me. My home group, when they found out, they didn't scold me, they didn't turn their backs on me. I had 8 years sober and Alcoholics Anonymous and was going to be a single mom, and nobody said anything, but what a great mom I was going to be and how excited they were once I did finally decide that I was going to keep the baby. But I will tell you, I did not know. I did not wake up and know for sure that I was going to be a mom. I was scared, and I wanted to make sure that he got the best life that he could possibly get, and I knew I had some friends who couldn't have kids, and that there was a possibility that I had a plan. Like, I may decide to give him up for adoption, and I was going to move, and I was going to go, because I wanted him to have what was best. I did not want his life to be ruined because of me and because of the decisions that I had made, you know? And I sat in the room for Alcoholics Anonymous, holding this on me, not knowing what to do. And it was those moments that it was imperative for me to have a relationship with a higher power, imperative for me to have a relationship with other alcoholics and my sponsor in my home group, because I could have died in Alcoholics Anonymous not knowing what to do. And I fainted 13 weeks sober, I woke up in the middle of the night and I passed out. And so I went to work the next day and called my mom, and she's like, yeah, you need to go to the doctor. So 13 weeks pregnant, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And we went and they did an ultrasound to make sure that the baby was okay, because I was okay. And whenever she was doing the ultrasound, you know, I've had ultrasounds before, you know, 13 weeks pregnant, it was like my third one. There was a moment that she took a picture, and she printed the picture out, she showed it to me, and it was my child. I didn't know what he was at the time, but my child, he was kicked back with his legs crossed and his feet out. I could see all 10 of his little toes, and he was like all crossed with his arms behind his back, his head just chilled out. He was chillaxing. Like he was meant to be there. Literally, I have the picture, y'all. It is absurd. Like, I've never seen anything like it. It looks like it's fake, and I'm like, and she's like, look, he looks so happy to be there. And I was like, okay, maybe he's supposed to be here. Maybe he really is supposed to be here. And that's when I decided that my son and I were going to go on this journey together. And I love him. It was a hard journey. I had a hard pregnancy. Whenever I had him, he wasn't breathing. He had to be in the NICU for a week. When they take your baby away from you, you don't get to see them for hours and hours and hours after you've had them. It is the worst pain I've ever felt in my life. But I have a relationship with a higher power, and I knew that everything was going to be okay. I just had to stick it through it. And then I had to bust it out of that NICU. It was crazy. But finally. I did. I felt like a baby stealer, even after they had discharged him, because it was so ridiculous. But, you know, we finally got to go home, and I had to learn how to do all these things, you know. And babies do come with instruction manuals, I will tell you. So if you ever get pregnant, please call me, because there are instruction manuals to help you out, regardless of which way you decide to go. But, you know, but I had this little life, and he was so amazing, and he becomes more amazing every day, you know. I'm taking a demotion at work, you know. I worked so hard to get where I was. And the decision that I had to make for me and my son is that in 10 years, I would rather be a poor mom that doesn't have a lot of money, that does the absolute best that she can to give him what she can, than a mother that wasn't there for him and that had to buy for time. I don't want to be that mom. I want to spend every breathing second that I possibly can with him. I want to show him every wondrous thing that he can ever see. I want to take him on journeys. I want him to see the stars with me for the first time. I want him to see the sunset. I want it to be an awesome journey. And so in order to be able to do that, I have to take a very large pay cut and demotion at work. But I'm okay with it, you know? I'm very excited. As we walk hand in hand on this journey, you know, I know that I'm going to be able to give him the most of what I have, and that's me, not money. And, you know, we're going to build a beautiful life, and it's going to be awesome until the day that he doesn't need me anymore. And hopefully I'll be able to hand him off to his higher power, and hopefully he'll be good, you know. His dad and I maintain contact. He's seen pictures, you know. It's an odd relationship. What can you do, you know? He's as participative as he can be right now, due to the nature of his life. And I totally understand that. And I hold no animosity towards him. It's hard to be in the situation I am with an active alcoholic. It's very odd, please let me tell you. But because I work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and I have a relationship with a higher power, I'm a lot more forgiving in that relationship. I'm a really good baby mama. You know, there were a lot of things that happened in the time during my pregnancy. There were a lot of feelings and emotions and things that happened. I actually had to talk to a lot of people and convince them that, because there were a lot of women. When you're a single woman and you get pregnant, people get mad at you. I mean, it's a horrible truth. I had two coworkers that had stopped talking to me, unbeknownst to me. They called me to tell me, like, that they had been mad at me because I was pregnant. They'd been trying to get pregnant and were. And all this horrible stuff, like, and, you know, and I had to sit on the phone with them, pat their hands, and tell them, like, it's okay, I understand, you know, and I'm sitting there, like, I'm trying to convince them that it's okay that I'm pregnant, like, what is that about? But I did it because I have a relationship with a higher power, and it wasn't about who's right or who's wrong or what it is about. What it was about was, I'm going to have a beautiful life with my son, you know? And even though I did not hurt them directly, you know, they had some emotional affliction to it, and I did not want them to have that, and so I did what I could to support them. And me and those women have a great relationship today, you know. I have a beautiful and amazing life. It is huge, and there is so much stuff that goes on it on a daily basis. You know, a year before I had my kid to the day, I had gone to D.C. for a week and then come and go on Circuit Pop for 5 hours so we could go to the dance and then drove home and gone to Jamaica the next day. That was what my life was. And a year later, I was having a child cut out of me. And let me tell you, the best lesson that I learned is that you don't know what's going to happen next. It doesn't mean that it's bad. It just means that things are different, you know? And it's so beautiful. I never imagined it. I wasn't the person that wanted kids. I didn't want this life. This was not... If you had told the girl that walked in here on May 15, 2003, that broken girl, that she was going to have the life that she has today, that she was going to have to make the decisions that she has to make today, that she was going to have to breathe through some of the worlds that she was going to have to breathe through today, I don't think that girl would have made it. I really don't. I have a beautiful life because of Alcoholics Anonymous, because of the program, and because of the beautiful people in it, and I'm so grateful for it. I'm going to read you one last thing as I close. Perhaps one of the greatest rewards of meditation and prayer is the sense of belonging that comes to us. We no longer live in a completely hostile world. We are no longer lost and frightened and purposeless. The moment we catch even a glimpse of God's will, the moment we begin to see truth, justice, and love as the real and eternal things in life, we are no longer deeply disturbed by all the seeming evidence to the contrary that surrounds us in purely human form. We know that God lovingly watches over us. We know that when we turn to Him, all will be well with us there and hereafter. And thank you very much for my beautiful life and letter, Ben.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.